Hello and welcome to On the Line. I'm Carl Richter. Today, Dr. Laura Sykes is back to continue our local history series with the story of the Great Red River Raft. Say that 10 times fast. It's a unique geographical natural feature that plays a big part in the history of the region. And I think you'll be interested in hearing how this phenomenon has affected the Four States region, its economy, its politics, etc. So here's my latest conversation with Dr. Laura Sykes. All right, here we are for the next part of our local history series. And today we are taking on the Great Red River Raft, which is not a boat.
That's right. It's an ecological formation. It is a sort of junk raft of all of these trees that have fallen over the course of probably about the last 400 years into the Red River. And they just pile up and pile up until they form 150-mile-long obstruction in the middle of the Red River.
Which had sort of its own ecology. Stuff was growing on top of it.
Yeah.
And wildlife lived in it.
You kind of have to lament the loss of such a unique ecological feature.
Right.
And in fact, it's one of the unique features of North America. There were a lot of things going on the raft. And so I thought we would start by talking about a description from the time. And this is a description from 1819 of the raft. I hardly know how to give you a description of this raft, but perhaps you can get the best idea of it by imagining yourself in a large swamp, grown up with trees and filled up with driftwood, wedged in very closely, the water having no particular current and running in no particular direction. During the 30 days, we saw land but two or three times, and then only some small islands. At night, we tied our boats to a tree and remained till morning. Sometimes we would come across the lakes 2 or 3 miles in extent, and then again we would spend a whole day in moving not further than the length of the boat. But I must not forget to tell you of the immense quantity of bee trees we found in this raft. At any time, we could go out in our dugout and return laden with a large quantity of honey, which we found truly delicious. There are places where the water can be seen in motion under the logs. In other places, the whole width of the river may be crossed on horseback, and boats only make their way in passing these places by following the inlet of a lake and coasting to its outlet and thus finding the channel again. Weeds, flowering shrubs, and small willows had taken surface on the root of the surface of the timber and flourish above the waters. He also talks about how there are lots of snakes. He says an infinite number of snakes are living in these massive in this massive tangle of all of these trees. So when we say it's a raft, I mean it was thick. You could walk on it. There were trees growing on it that had circumferences of 12 inches in diameter.
Yeah, yeah. I should say I looked up the origin of the word raft, and it's interesting. The word raft, as we normally think of it, meaning like some logs tied together to float on, like a boat-type raft, that word has a whole separate origin from raft in this sense, which means an obstacle. So I thought that was interesting.
That is interesting. We love etymology. And this is a raft that is an obstruction, and it's going to be something that prevents the settlement and exploration of this area for quite a long time. Now, that is actually beneficial to some of the people who are living here, the Caddo.
Let's pinpoint exactly where this is on the Red River.
Absolutely.
For the longest time, I thought it was on the northern part of the Red that is now the border between Texas and Oklahoma. But
that
no.
would be more of like the furthest northern extent of it. Right. So it's going to extend essentially from around Texarkana all the way down to Natchitoches, Louisiana,
right,
passing through Shreveport. Now, of course, Shreveport didn't exist at the earliest period that we're talking about, because Shreveport is only created by the removal of the raft. So Natchitoches, which we talked about last time in our Caddo podcast, was a thriving little settlement. But to get from Natchitoches to here was nearly impossible over water. You had to go over land and sometimes cross the raft itself, go in and out of channels. It made it very difficult for people to move around. That was a positive thing for the Caddo who live up here in Texarkana, because they are protected from sort of incursions to a certain degree. But more importantly, they're protected from their land being snatched up, because it is prohibitively difficult for people to move around in this area. And so we don't see that land being snapped up by settlers in this area until actually after the removal of the raft itself. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they're going to move in after the first removal of the raft and then have to move out again after it rebuilds. And then they're going to come back in again, right? So the raft really determines, in a sense, how this place is developed and how it is settled. And it's changing over time. The Caddo people lived with the Great Raft as part of their ecological system, right? Mm-hmm. This is part of their natural world. And in the Caddo Nation, there are even stories of them using the shifts, the creaks, the cracks, the moans of the raft as a way to measure time or seasons. And so what we see is that they were using the raft sort of in its natural state as part of their world. And they, you know, had learned to adjust to its, you know, different whims. And so it's going to really be the Europeans, the Americans, who are going to come in and try to get rid of it.
Right.
Now, the reason they want to get rid of it is because we have this big competition going on for land in the United States. As we know, some of the first people who come here from Europe are going to be French. And the French have essentially this big investment in the Louisiana Purchase. It's not the Louisiana Purchase yet at this time, right? But this is supposed to be their colony in North America, all the way from the Mississippi down from Minnesota all the way down to Louisiana. But it's a problem because there's a part of this territory that they can't really explore, they can't really get into because of the Great Raft. And so some of the earliest writing we see from the European perspective about this raft is going to be from the French, who describe it as an impossible barrier. As I say, the raft has been here for hundreds of years. And the book that Carl and I both read about the Great Raft preparing for this is called actually No Hope, The Story of the Great Red River Raft by Mitchell Whittington. And I think the No Hope is really indicative of how people felt about the sort of permanency of this raft and about the impossibility of removing it.
Yeah, it must have seemed like moving a mountain or something.
Yeah, and if you think about it, it was, you know, it wasn't just something, as we know, that would have to be removed one time, because this is a process, right? It's a process that is ongoing. Each year, as, you know, the storms come, as the winds come, and even as freezes come, more trees are going to fall into the water and join as part of this raft, right? So even once we address it the first time, it's going to take a lot more attempts to actually get it under control. So even after they removed it the first time, it still seems hopeless to a lot of them to actually get rid of it permanently. But they want to, because we need to be able to navigate those waters, the Europeans do, the Americans do, in order to develop the land. Now, for the Americans, this becomes a very important issue. once we actually get that land from the Louisiana Purchase, because it's no longer the French problem. It's an American problem. And one of the things that we have to remember about the 1800s, which is the period when the raft is finally going to be cleared, is that this is the time of the Industrial Revolution. In England, they're experiencing the First Industrial Revolution. We also have the effects of the First Industrial Revolution here in the United States, although the Second Industrial Revolution is going to be our big wheelhouse. The First Industrial Revolution, though, brings one invention that is going to be crucial to the development of the story.
I was about to say, the steam engine. Right?
That's right, the steam engine. So once the steam engine is developed, it's going to change everything. It's going to change our whole world, the way that we produce and consume things, the way we move across the land. But it's also going to change the way that we feel a sense of power over the land and control. This is a time when we're really going into nature, especially in the Deep South, and we are beginning to, for instance, along the Mississippi Delta, we're beginning to have machinery that can actually clear some of this land for the first time. And now with the steamboat, we have this need on these rivers to be able to go up and down them very quickly because these steamboats are making us move faster, right?
Right.
We can go faster, we can go further in a shorter period of time. At the same time that all of this is happening, in England, they are developing a textile industry that is unlike anything the world has ever seen. Because they have the steam engine. Every single thing that they used to do by hand can now be done by a machine.
Right.
And previously, for centuries, England's biggest export was wool. So they have this whole industry based on textiles. Well, once the steam engine comes in, they go through their wool reserves very quickly, right? You only have so many sheep.
Right.
So they need more material to bring in to use in these fabric shops, these textile mills. And where is that going to come from? Ultimately, it comes from the American South and what we call King Cotton, okay? Mm-hmm. So the demand for cotton is going to skyrocket in the 1800s. The best land for growing cotton is in the Deep South, and it becomes very, very valuable, right? Mm-hmm. So plantations are springing up all over the South, and what happens is that the land here is viewed as potentially valuable cotton land that can't be utilized, right?
Right.
Now, no one's thinking at this time about, well, not no one, but no one in charge is thinking at this time about nature and like the environment and stuff like that. It's really about how we can exploit these natural resources for our gain, right?
Right, right.
And so what happens is the American government begins to turn towards the idea of perhaps addressing this raft. We're not only in a period where the land is very valuable, but we're also in a period where new technology is making it possible for us to have some sort of control over nature.
Right.
Although I think that they had a little bit of hubris about how much control they actually had over nature at this point.
But who can blame them? I mean, there's this new technology that does make what once was impossible possible.
That's right. And they really feel like masters of nature, And nature, of course, is going to have a few things to say about that on its own. But in general, we do see that they are able to harness this new technology in order to come in and affect the ecology here. And the guy who is going to be sort of charged with this task by the federal government is a guy named Captain Henry Shreve. Now, that name should be familiar to you guys. He is the person after whom Shrevetown, now called Shreveport, is named. But the reason that he gets that honor is because of his role in removing the Great Raft. Shreveport was only possible after the Great Raft's removal because it was never going to grow. Excuse me, it was never going to grow like it did if it wasn't able to get goods in and out.
Right.
So they had to remove this raft. But all of this is still a twinkle in Henry Shreve's eye at this point. What Henry Shreve does that makes him so notable in history is that he harnesses this new technology, the steamboat, to create a new invention called the snag boat. But they're essentially these steamboats, flat-bottom steamboats, that have cranes on them. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be able to use the snag boat to grab these logs and remove them one by one and process them, okay? Get them out of that water. And it's going to take a long time to do it. We have to remember we're talking about 150 miles of this.
Right.
Okay?
A gigantic game of pickup sticks.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so the federal government is going to hire Henry Shreve with his invention of the snag boats to come in and remove the Red River Raft. And this is paid for by the federal government. It's seen as a one-off task, which is going to turn out to be a problem because it is not a one-off task, right? The raft is actually going to be removed and then reform very quickly thereafter. And we're going to have ongoing removal efforts, which I'm sure still exists today.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's much more technologically advanced.
Right.
But he's going to get out there with the snag boats, and he is going to, as you said, you know, play this massive game of pickup sticks, getting each of these logs out of the water one by one so they can move up the river.
And in the process, he becomes sort of mythologized in a way. He is really seen as a heroic figure.
A visionary.
Yeah. And someone who was able to, you know, kill the giant, so to speak.
Absolutely.
I have to tell people one book I ordered that I thought was going to be another sort of study of the Great Raft turned out to be a children's picture book all about how great Henry Shreve was.
If you look at some of the images from this time, you know, yeah. I mean, he is presented as this like masterful statesman standing astride the raft, you know, yeah. in his beautiful suit and pointing into the distance with a look of greatness on his face, right? Certainly. And I think that if you were born in Shreveport like I was, you know, you were, or if you're from around here, you automatically are born with some of this notion of Henry Shreve. And in fact, he was a very larger than life figure. He was a guy who believed in himself very much and was able to actually turn that into action. The War Department is going to be involved with this at several points, but mostly it's going to be the Congress who is going to fund these efforts. Here is a description of the snag boat Heliopolis, which is going to be one of the snag boats that is going to remove the raft. As one account explains, while jeering onlookers hooted, the snag boat drove head-on a massive planter, a half-submerged tree. There was a booming impact and crash. It seemed to the onlookers that the boat must be shattered to pieces, but there it was, still intact, and the huge tree toppling into the water. A spontaneous cheer went up.
Nice.
Everyone's so excited.
Yeah.
And so some of these snag boats are going to be nicknamed Uncle Sam's Tooth Pullers.
Nice.
Which I think is a really cute description of what's going on here.
Yeah.
These are the people who are going to conduct this removal. They're going to be living out on these boats for months at a time, even years in some cases. It's going to take several years to actually remove all of it. As far as the timeline goes, we have Captain Shreve arriving at the foot of the raft in 1833. He's going to have about 150 men that are going to work on the removal of the raft with him. And they're going to complete their work in 1838. Almost immediately, though, the raft begins to rebuild once they're finished removing it. And this is going to cause some issues for the government. And we have to remember that the federal government is new at this time, right? Our country is new. The federal government is new. And the idea that the federal government should do massive public works like this is still fairly controversial. We have some of this going on up in the north with the Erie Canal and some of Henry Clay's big projects. But in general, it's going to be difficult to convince the federal government to pay for this stuff, especially more than once.
Right.
The real thing that's going to influence when we do go back in and mess with it, it really has to do with either commerce or war, right?
Right.
When we need to get back and forth to either sell or work the land, or whenever we're going to get into a scrape or a potential scrape, right?
Right.
And that really matters because, as we talked about in the last podcast, there's conflict going on in this region that they cannot access, right? There are threats of fights going on with the Texans, with different Native American groups. And so what we see is that the federal government is going to have more of a vested interest as time moves on in removing this raft. And when they don't have that interest in the raft, it just kind of sits there with people making effort after effort to get more funding to remove it.
Yeah, it was just occurred to me that Texas independence happened within this stretch in 1836.
And then during that time, we had all of these border skirmishes, right, up in this area over, you know, what was going to, who was going to be in control and all of that stuff. So the federal government is very interested in being able to be in there and control the situation, which they can't do until the raft is removed.
Yeah.
The process was very difficult. A lot of the people who were working on the raft fell prey to yellow fever. Which is common, you know, in this area at the time.
Isn't it spread by mosquitoes?
It is. It's mosquito-borne. And so you have to remember, they're on the water.
Yeah.
You know, it's just going to be a pretty dangerous type of work. They claimed in 1836 a loss of 9,006 man days due to illness and sickness.
Wow.
So as you can imagine, they were probably feeling pretty bad, you know. I mean, it was a hard process.
Yeah, this is not a fun job.
Right. It is hard work. It's physical labor, you know. They are getting paid, though, for the most part by the federal government. So most of the people who were working on it for pay probably thought it was a pretty good opportunity. Mm-hmm. Problem was that even as they're removing it, they notice that it's beginning to build up again.
Right.
And this is distressing for them because they think, which is going to prove to be true, they think this is just going to come back as soon as we finish removing it.
Yeah.
And they don't really have a plan for stopping that from happening. We're going to get a plan a little bit later, an idea that we should build levees on each side of the river to prevent these trees from falling in.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But at this time, the focus is really more on just removing it. And ultimately, what we're going to see is that the thing that's going to have the biggest effect over time is this sort of looking more towards a maintenance system of actually
right.
preventing the trees from getting in there in the first place.
Right.
Now, I want to say something about the trees in it. Because of the anaerobic nature of water, I guess. Mm-hmm. Listen, I'm not a scientist, but
right.
The logs that are in the raft, the ones that are submerged, they don't rot because they're like sitting in the water, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like these, you know, if a log falls on dry land, it just, you know, decays.
Yeah. Right.
Here we have them building up over time. And that's one of the reasons why the Great Raft becomes such a big impediment.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the area, as far as the city of Shreveport, is going to be removed by 1838, which is what we said, this date at which Captain Shreve kind of stops the first effort to remove the raft, which means that only part of the raft is removed. It still extends all the way up here to Texarkana.
Yeah.
But they only remove it so far as Shreveport, Shrevetown. And this is very quickly developed. We see steamboats going up and down the river almost immediately once the raft is removed. And more importantly, for the purposes of economic development, we have plantations springing up. These are plantations that would have been worked by slaves.
And the Red River feeds into the Mississippi, is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
That's what I thought.
And so what this means is that if you go like in South Louisiana to Plantation Alley, you'll see that almost all the plantations are situated on rivers or waterways. Why? Because otherwise you had to move all that cotton and stuff over land. And it was very expensive and time consuming.
Yeah.
If you can move it by water, it's a much better deal. And so what we see is that as the Red River Raft is removed, the land alongside it is plucked up very quickly by landowners. Now, I want to remind you guys that these landowners would not have been ordinary folks like you and me.
Right.
It's quite expensive to have land in the first place, much less the numerous slaves that you would have to work the land, each of whom would have a value in the economy of something like a nice car or a small house, right?
Right.
So, Carl, you and I would never be able to afford that, no matter how long we worked, right?
Yeah.
So the people who are snatching up these plantations are very wealthy people. And so the land that has been there may have previously been worked by the Caddo, or it may have previously been worked by small landholders. Now it's getting turned into these massive plantations, right? Think about like corporate farms kind of.
Yeah.
You have to have a massive investment to get into this. And so the plantation system is expanding into our region as a result of the removal of the raft. Later, as the raft reforms, they're actually going to remove some of the large cotton plants from these plantations and move them back downriver.
Right.
Until they can get back into the plantations via the newly removed Red River Raft, right? So, essentially, the economy hinges on the river. And I read one paper that was really interesting that said, you know, you can kind of think of it as a controlled variable. Right? With and without the river, how these plantations do and how the development goes. You can really see that it's dependent on this method of transportation.
Right. That's interesting.
It was. I wish I remembered the name of it, but we might put it in the notes if I remember. So 1838, he removes it to Shreveport. He gets this town named after him. The land from the town comes from swindling the Caddo people. they get a guy who's, as the book says, quote, this is not my phrase, but a half-breed Caddo. In other words, someone who's part Caddo.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, will you sell us this land? And the guy's like, oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, whatever.
And they're like, great. He's Caddo. He sold it to us. And the Caddo are like, we don't even know this guy.
Right.
He's like barely one of us. They actually take it all the way to Congress, right? Which, of course, Congress, who do you think they sided with?
The rich white guys.
Yeah. So they take it all the way to Congress, and ultimately it's going to be upheld. But this is part of our national record. This is something that's very important to the Caddo Nation, as well as the development of this area. A similar process is going to happen for all of this land that's going to be taken up by these settlers. In 1838, it's cleared up to Shreveport, but here in the Texarkana area, we're still penned in by the raft. So in 1839, Captain Shreve is going to go to Congress, and he's going to ask for more money to keep the river clear and to prevent new buildup. Because by 1841, they had already seen significant buildup of the raft, and he, of course, by 1839, already knew that this was coming.
Yeah.
And so the raft is going to almost immediately reform. Now, American politics are going to play a major role in how this stuff works. At the time, in 1841, we're going to see the Whig Party take over for the Jacksonian Democrats. The Jacksonian Democrats, very Southern oriented. Mm-hmm. That's what Henry Shreve was. And so the government under the Jacksonian Democrats was giving him money to do this stuff. Now that we've passed the torch to the Whigs, they don't want to fund this anymore, okay?
Right.
So it's going to be sort of neglected for a while. Meantime, you know, people are going to go out and try with other methods to remove this. They're going to try to create private companies that are going public in order to get funding. In other words, they would create a private company and they'd say, okay, if you invest in our company to remove the raft, then you'll get a portion of the toll. They're going to charge a toll to go up and down the river.
Oh, right.
You're going to get a portion of that in order to pay you back, okay?
Yeah.
It's kind of like investment schemes.
Yeah.
The Congress, by 1841, is going to appropriate $75,000 to remove the latest incarnation of the raft. This is going to be farmed out to a private contract. And this guy named Thomas Williamson, who was originally one of Shreve's guys, one of his compatriots, he's going to be put in charge of removing the raft. But it turns out he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't really learn much from working with Captain Shreve, and it's going to turn into a massive failure. He really didn't understand how the work was done, and he was unable to keep the river clear. And so people begin to become convinced at this point that it's impossible to remove, all right?
Right.
No hope.
Yeah.
In 1845, the raft is pretty big, and so the Army Corps of Engineers is going to ask for more funds. The federal government is going to investigate. They don't end up allocating funds. So what people begin to do is think, okay, well, what if we just, like, accept that the raft is always going to be here and we come up with alternatives?
Right.
So one of the alternatives was a transportation company that would carry you, like, across the raft.
Right.
Which sounds like crazy.
Yeah.
Another way was they were trying to build channels and little canals to get around it. So you would go from, like, inlet through this canal and then sort of, like, sidestep.
Around it, yeah.
Skirt it, right? The raft is really, some people are really beginning to look at the raft as inevitable and think more along the lines of how can we live with it rather than trying to fight it.
Yeah.
Now, in the 1850s, we're going to have a civil engineer named Charles Fuller, who was a member of the U.S. Military Academy. He's going to come down and do some more work on it. They're going to assess the cost of removing the raft at $12,000 per mile. Think about that in today's money.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's a lot.
$1,850.
I wish we had a converter on us, but I mean, we're talking.
I'm going to look it up.
Yeah, Carl's going to look it up. So we're talking a lot of money. And at the time, it would have required the Congress to approve over $150,000. And this is going to begin. Carl's going to get that total for us. So this is going to, work's going to begin on the project in 1855. A lot of this idea is at this point talking about removing parts of the raft so we can get around it. Okay. So rather than like Shreve was doing, removing the raft itself, a lot of the new work in the 1850s has to do with trying to negotiate around it.
According to the internet's, $12,000 in 1855 would be equivalent to about $434,000 today.
Dang.
Yeah.
That's a lot of, for a mile, 1 mile.
Right.
And we have.
So it's basically $1 million every 2 miles or something like that.
And then you have to think about the fact that this thing keeps coming back.
Yeah.
So the government's like, why are we going to spend all of that money when we just spent money, you know, a few years ago to do this? They don't want to spend money anyway, you know, much less over and over again to do the same thing. So this is going to actually be a period sort of after the 1850s where we're not going to do a whole lot on the raft. And the reason for that is because we have something pretty big going on here in the South, right?
Yeah.
This is when we begin our buildup towards the Civil War, our conflict with the federal government in the South. And it is going to be neglected. I mean, the South didn't have enough manufacturing power to create guns, you know, much less snag boats and things like that.
Yeah, right.
Although the river is very important to, you know, being able to navigate the area, they did not have the means or the ability to actually remove the raft themselves. And during this period of conflict with the South, of course, the federal government isn't going to be investing in that. Right,
right. Yeah.
So there's going to be a period in the 1850s and 1860s where the raft is kind of just sitting there.
And I'm sure the Southerners would be focused on the Mississippi mostly.
Absolutely.
And just using their resources there. Just because it's like the superhighway.
Sure. And we also have all of these, during the Civil War itself, we also have a lot of battles going on the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's going to be the war that's going to bring the next bit of attention to the Red River Raft. Now, early in the war, the North actually takes large swaths of Louisiana, in particular, New Orleans and Baton Rouge. If you look at a map of 1863, most of southern Louisiana is controlled by the Union, which is an interesting point because that means the Emancipation Proclamation did not actually apply to there. It only applied to places that were under Confederate control. These areas are going to be very important for the U.S. Army because they produce cotton.
Right.
The North needs cotton. They're running low on it, which you can imagine why. I mean, the place that produced it.
Yeah, right.
So they take these cotton plantations down in South Louisiana. They're very important, and they keep them running, right? They are still running these plantations and using the cotton that they grow to build, to, you know, sew uniforms and things like that,
right,
essential
and
stuff.
And just sell it for.
Right. I mean, it's a huge part of the economy, right?
Right.
Even though we're not as industrial as England, we still have, in the North especially, our little industrial situation. So what's going to happen is that there is going to be the need in 1864 to clear the Red River once more. The reason is because some people were saying, there were rumblings, as the book says, that a combination of French and Mexican forces might join with the Confederacy against the Union, and they might come up through the Rio Grande to join up with the Confederate forces sort of on the Louisiana-Texas border and threaten the control of the North, especially in those cotton-growing areas that they're really trying to control.
Right.
And so the federal government sees that it's important not only to seize the cotton plantations along the Red River, but also to have troops in here to protect their advances. During the war, we have something called the Red River Campaign, mm-hmm. and it is an essential part of the war in this region. And Abraham Lincoln in 1864 is going to turn his attention once again to the to clearing the Red River. Now that the federal government is involved again, and not just, you know, as sort of an outside party, but someone who sees this as necessary to their goals, they're going to begin to think more along the lines of preserving, right, the area and the clearness of the area. Because they've noticed, obviously, as we have, that the efforts, although well-intentioned, are really not making much headway in the face of nature. So they're going to start to think about building dams. They're going to start to build these levees, the levee systems that if you're from around here, you grew up seeing everywhere.
Right.
Right? They're going to begin to use the engineering capabilities of the Union Army to create some of these preventative measures so that the raft doesn't come back. And so we're going to have some dams being constructed. These dams are going to prevent the rafts from the components of the raft from going further downriver. And we also have some people calling for the removal once again of the raft. The government is still fairly reluctant to take on that task beyond the necessary in the moment. But we're finally going to get a little bit of movement in the 1870s. Now, the area up to Shreveport, as we talked about, had been cleared. It is rebuilding in that area, right?
Right.
But it was cleared all the way through Shreveport, leaving the big chunk of it from Shreveport to here in Texarkana,
right,
okay, along the Red River. So it should be no surprise to you guys that the final sort of taming of the raft is completed in 1873. Do you know what else happened in 1873, Carl?
I don't know.
Pop quiz. The founding of Texarkana.
Oh, that's right. Of course.
So as that raft is removed, that is part of the reason why we exist at that time, while we come into being, because it's the first time people can get up here.
How soon I've forgotten last year's sesquicentennial.
That's right. Unforgettable celebration. Was wonderful. So what's going to happen is all of that area, all of this land that we talked about, which had been up until this point controlled mostly by the Caddo Nation, is going to be piecemeal sold off as that remaining portion is cleared and as the Red River becomes passable, right? So once we remove the last portion of the raft, which is this sort of 70 miles between here and Shreveport, that's when the river is going to become passable, and that's when we become incorporated into this story.
Yeah.
They're going to do it once again with snag boats. The snag boat idea is really indispensable to the process here. They're also going to use a lot of TNT.
Right.
Explosives. They're just going to blow it up.
Like, yeah.
Especially over time, right? As we get further along in time, like towards the 1900s, we're just going to blow stuff up.
Yeah. Why not?
So they have TNT out there. Yeah. Well, I don't know if TNT exists at this point. It's around then.
Nitroglycerin, yeah, right? Which is what?
High explosives.
Right.
And so, again, we have the workers out there contracting diseases, yellow fever. And one of the guys who's in charge of this process in 1873, whose name is Lieutenant Woodruff, he is going to supervise the process, and he is himself going to die of yellow fever contracted in the removal of the raft. And so he's going to be viewed as a martyr, according to a local newspaper.
And didn't his brother then take over? I think that's right.
That's right. So essentially what we see is that this is a cause that's viewed by the public as something that's for the greater good. I think that today we might have some questions about that, although we might not. I think that it's probably complicated. But I do think that there are unintended consequences to removing the raft that we might be able to see now that we weren't seeing back then.
Yeah.
Or at least the people in charge weren't seeing back then.
Right.
Right. The removal of the Native Americans being one, the increasing, as King Cotton moves into our area, so does the slave trade. We have massive numbers of slaves who are coming into the area as a result of this. And also, of course, just the ecological loss of a system. On the other hand, of course, is development, right? The development of this area. So as with all sort of modernity, we have these complicated processes that are at work.
And didn't it affect some inland waterways? Like, how is it they got to Jefferson, Texas?
Okay, so Jefferson used to be like this little bypass, right? So you used to be able to bypass the Red River Raft by going through Jefferson. And Jefferson is going to be a boom town because of that, because they're going to have all of these. If you look at pictures of Jefferson from before the clearance of the raft, they have all of these steamboats in the harbor. They're booming, right?
Right.
And then after the Red River the Red River Raft is clear, this is when Jefferson begins its decline, because it's no longer necessary, right? We no longer have to go through this bypass in Jefferson, Texas, to get there.
Yeah, it's just like when a freeway goes through a town and the railroad town gets left behind.
Exactly.
Or something like that.
That is exactly right. And that's why Jefferson is a little bit frozen in time. And I think also amazing for that reason.
You know,
it sort of reached this peak during the late 1800s and then sort of, like you said, got left behind.
Yeah.
These snag boats are going to be employed by the federal government through the 1920s. This is an invention that is going to be used throughout the United States. And in fact, some of our snag boats are going to be sent to other places, including the Ohio River, as one of our snag boats ended up there clearing stuff. So this is not only important for our area, but also an innovation that's going to be used by a lot of different people.
Yeah.
But after this point, you know, we have the creation of these levees that are going to prevent the buildup. We have the Army Corps of Engineers looking after the river itself. there is a little aside that I wanted to make that I told Carl about. Actually, during the war, during World War II, we end up having some Nazi POWs, some German prisoners of war, who are going to work on some of these levees and dams right here in the area to help keep the Red River passable.
Wow, that's so interesting. I've heard stories about those camps around here.
Absolutely.
And but I never knew that part.
It's fascinating when you think about those camps, just as like a little thing to think about, how people in the local area saw them being treated. So these German Nazi POWs are often being treated better and more equal than African-Americans and Native Americans here in this region, right?
Yeah.
Which, of course, is startling for us to think about, but the nature of things as it was then, sadly.
Yeah.
So the Great Red River Raft is gone now, and it's probably not coming back, right? as long as we have something to do with it. But it was something that was really unique to the North American landmass. It's one of the largest geological formations. Geological, is that the right word? Yeah.
Now that would be more like land and rocks. But maybe natural.
Natural formations in North America.
Yeah.
It was around for hundreds of years. And if you had lived here at any time before the sort of removal of the raft, you would have situated a lot of your life around it, around getting around it. But you might not have necessarily thought of it as just a bad thing or an obstacle. It might have been just a part of normal life.
Yeah, something, I don't know, like the Grand Canyon or or Niagara Falls or something like that.
And certainly the Caddo, I mean, they had a relationship with the raft, and it did protect them for much longer. If you look at the sort of development of this area, it comes much later than it does in a lot of other places. Mm-hmm. And that is because the Red River Raft prevented the exploitation and development of this area.
Yeah, I don't remember where I read it, but it also caused flooding, which deposited rich soil on the banks of the river.
Great point.
Great for agriculture.
So one of the things that we see is that over this period, we're increasingly trying to control rivers. This is not just something that we're doing here in the Red River area. We're doing it with the Mississippi. This is when we're sluicing out the bottom of the Mississippi to try and make the water go faster. And all of this effluvium is sending alluvial dirt off of a continental shelf, you know, and this is where we get like wetland erosion. There are also unintended consequences here, right, where our ecosystem is maintained by the continual process of flooding and the depositing of these alluvial deposits that make the land so rich, right?
Right.
And now that the raft isn't here, those things just move downriver, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just interesting to think about how we normally these days think of Texarkana as built by the railroads, but the Red River had a lot to do with, like you said, the founding and the early development of Texarkana.
That's actually kind of funny because we spend all of this money and all this time and all this energy removing the raft because steamboats are it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly we have a new transportation mode, and now the steamboats are practically, you know, unimportant.
Yeah.
And you're right. It is the railroad that really causes us to boom. But I don't think that the city would have been settled in the first place if we hadn't been able to access it through the raft, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be funny because the need for all of this is going to be very quickly obviated by the introduction of the railroads.
Right.
Now we're just going to send that cotton on a railroad, right? But at this time, the most efficient way to move things around was by steamboat, and so we wanted to be able to get in there and maximize the potential.
And now there are ongoing efforts, ideas about making the Red River here navigable again, which it's not now, apparently. And I gather that it's sort of hard to make the case that we even need to do that, much less invest all the money it would take. So we'll stay tuned on the Red River.
Yeah, I think that what we've seen from history is that there tends to be a a situation in which the government only funds it, where there's like a national security or a major economic need. And so right. I doubt that we're going to be seeing a lot of movement on that until the next exigent situation rises. And then we'll see what happens.
Yeah, maybe a canoe or a kayak. No more barges.
So next time you go outside and you're looking at the Red River, imagine just being able to walk right across it on a raft made of logs. And you have blackberry bushes growing in it. You have honeybees right. living in it.
Snakes snapping at your heels.
Flowers.
Yeah.
So it would have been an entire ecosystem.
Habitat.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, deer lived there, rabbits lived there, snakes, as we mentioned.
Right.
So it would have been something that's really hard for us to even imagine today. That would have been very normal part of everyday life for the people who lived there at the time.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much. This is really interesting, as usual. We haven't decided what our next topic is going to be.
We talked a little bit about maybe railroads and foundation of Texarkana.
Yeah.
We also have reconstruction, but I think those two can join together.
Yeah.
Something along those lines.
Pretty big topics.
Yeah. So really what's going on as this area, as Texarkana is founded and as we begin to find our way.
Around the turn of the 20th century.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Carl. And if you guys have any questions or comments, we have gotten some in our inboxes from Just the Past podcast. We love to see that. And so any thoughts, any ideas you have for us, go ahead and send them in to the newspaper.
Yeah. I'll put our email addresses in the show notes.
Perfect.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye. On the Line is a Texarkana Gazette podcast recorded in Star Bear Studio, right here in downtown Texarkana, USA. Follow On the Line on our website, texarkanagazette.com/podcast. To support the show, post a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. And please, spread the word by sharing a link or telling a friend. I write, produce, and edit the show, and I'd love to hear from you. Email me at krichter@texarkanagazette.com and let me know what you think. I'll see you next time on The Line.